Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. That's right, you're not from Texas. Texas wants you anyway. So I was born.
Nice.
So I'm here at Worldcon, and why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself and tell people who you are and what you do.
So my name is Lorraine Hudson. I am the editor at Hunt Press. Jokingly, we refer to me as Madam Editor because there's this long-running joke about, you know, ooh, the editor. So the publisher, Angela Hunt, went ahead and added that to my title. So I'm Madam Editor of Hunt Press, which is a small press based in California.
And what kinds of things does Hunt Press do?
Mostly we came out of our perceived need, which is, of course, the perceived need of so many of the small presses out there, for somebody who was willing to take a little more time with the funky, off-the-wall niche, not going to be a blockbuster anytime this century until the author's dead, and then it'll be a classic sort of market. So
okay.
That's kind of where we're at. We've got science fiction titles, fantasy titles, and a couple of just, like, what-the-heck titles.
And you have a table here at Worldcon.
We do not have a table.
Oh, you don't have
a
table? I thought you did.
We do not.
Okay.
We do not. We are just walking around.
Okay.
Talking to people, which is my main goal here is outreach. Mm-hmm. I want to talk to people. We've presented at a couple of cons before. We had a big presence at LosCon last year in Los Angeles. And we did a bunch of panels on small press and editorial and whatnot. It kind of broke my heart when I was getting, because this is my first Worldcon. I've never done a Worldcon before. This one right here.
Okay,
never done this before.
That's right, because you got the little flag that says my first Worldcon.
I have this spiffy little, you know, rainbow.
Tie-dye neon thing, yeah.
I am new, make fun of me, you know, ribbon. So I, you know, because I'm a geek, I did a bunch of research before coming here, and, you know, I very dutifully read my entire, PDF packet of all
wow.
of the Hugo nominees.
Wow.
Oh, yes, read them, analyzed them, thought about them, went to the author's blogs, read those, did my Hugo voting timely.
And you said you listened to a bunch of podcast episodes, too.
I did. That was part of my whole research, because I'm like that. I'm a little research compulsive, which I think is part of the editorial bloodstream.
Sure.
We're all kind of like that to some degree. But it broke my heart reading the number of blogs by people who are in the industry, grounded in fandom and fantasy and science fiction, people who can name drop like mad things, who are, you know, submerged in this world, you know, past the neck, who said outright and in front, I have no idea how to vote for the editor categories. Broke.
I said
my
that.
Heart. You said that.
Yeah.
Lots of other people
said it. But do you know why I said that? Because you don't, when you pick up a book, you don't know who the editor is. That's why I said that. You have to hunt to figure out who it was, who edited the book. That's where I have the problem. I would prefer that it said, you know, such and such book by this person, and when you flip the page, there's a nice little editor credit right there. That's what I would prefer, because that would make
authors,
it easier for me.
A lot of authors are really good about crediting the editor somewhere, but yeah, we're kind of like the secret society almost, where everyone's afraid of us, everyone's intimidated by us, nobody knows what the heck we do, and we've sort of hit the ground as gatekeepers.
Okay.
And I don't like that at all, because gatekeeping is not my job. That's not what I'm supposed to do. Part of how I got into this gig and doing editorial for a small press is I used to be a developmental and acquisitions editor at Sun Microsystems,
okay.
The late great. And I had the greatest job in the whole world, because what I was paid to do is walk the halls, both, you know, literal and virtual, and poke my head in the door and see who was doing what.
Mm-hmm.
And get people to talk about this amazing, breathtaking, cutting-edge technology stuff they were doing. And I would literally walk into their offices, find a corner, sit down on the floor. I just watched them work and then say, hey, you could write an article about that thing. And they were always stunned. Like, really? Like, you think this is article about? Yeah. And so we'd sit there, and I had my little keyboard, and we'd just bash out like a rough outline or whatever. And you could see people sort of filling in the idea that, yes, this was an article, and yes, this thing that they're doing all alone in the dark in their cubicle, you know, with their Coke and their, you know, whatever.
Admit it, they drank Mountain Dew.
Some did, some don't. It, like, depends on the culture. But, you know, they would say, oh, but, like, the coders do Mountain Dew, but, like, yeah. the engineers are more like Coke. And then there was, like, that whole monster thing, but that was right before the crash, so
yeah.
I ignore that. But just watching people, watching their personal confidence in what they're doing, changing from, I am a geek alone in the dark doing this thing that no one else understands, to, hey, I have a published piece about this amazing thing that came out of my head. And I did that for 8 years for Sun Microsystems. The very first article that was ever published mainstream about RFID technology was something I pulled down out of somebody else's computer. Mm-hmm. Because she was like, I can't write about this. Like, yes, you can. This is awesome. This is fabulous stuff. So I began to start, you know, going to some of the smaller conventions and whatever, and realizing that it's exactly the same thing with new writers. They think, like, you know, they're sitting at home alone in the dark writing, you know, on their keyboards doing their story. And there needs to be a bridge. There needs to be somebody who bridges to those people and says, no, really, come on out. It's safe. It's like, come on out. Like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And some people have managed to make that leap fairly easily, but there's this whole mass, I think, of fandom who just hasn't gotten there yet. And again, it's like, I wish more editors were more out there and could just
right.
say, like, no, come to me. Like, let me help. Let me help you make this thing live.
Well, and I think there's a little bit of, just like with authors, all the social media, all the blogging and everything kind of took them all by surprise.
Right.
And there's some who are embracing it and doing stuff with it. And there's some who are dipping their toes in kind of tentatively.
Right.
And then there's some who are like, keep this away from me. I want nothing to do with it. And I think some of the editors are the same way. You know, you've got your Lee Harris and your Ellen Datlow and your Lou Anders who are out there talking to people and doing stuff. And then you have all these other editors who aren't.
Right. Right. And there's, you know, there's an intimidation thing mm-hmm. there, I'm sure. Because, like I said, we've been built into this sort of gatekeeper role. Like, do you want into this anthology? You have to impress me.
Right.
Rather than, let me help you. But it's like, it's a subtle twist, but I think it's an important twist. And I think that as more editors realize that they can talk to the writers don't bite, and the writers realize they can talk to the editors don't bite, I think there are so many stories out there that aren't coming out because they don't fit the niche that everyone's used to expecting to fill.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
One of the things, I had this talk with a friend of mine who's an ichthyologist. We were talking about...
He's a what now?
Ichthyologist.
Okay,
he's
what's
a fish
that?
Scientist.
Oh, okay.
He studies fish. And
that sounds fishy.
Totally. We were talking about Pacific Rim.
Okay.
Which, you know, the idea that science fiction can expand into not just rockets, but all the other sciences. There's lots of sciences out there. And there's this huge mass of fish geeks, bird geeks, you know, wildlife geeks. There's a beautiful article if you search for ichthyologists, which is the study of sand tracings. This guy who took the scene from the trailer for Pacific Rim, where you see the kaiju footprint in the sand,
mm-hmm.
he actually did this entire mathematical exposition of what a kaiju had to have looked like based on that footprint, and how the people who designed the kaiju characters, like, it had to have been this kaiju, not that one, because of this footprint and this depth and this sand. There's this whole realm of science stuff that isn't being written about because we've gotten into this rut where science fiction is spaceships and planets. It's not, you know, fish and sand tracings and birds and plants, and, like, we don't really go there all that much. Unless you're David Brin, and then you go there with the dolphins, but, you know, I digress.
Did you see there was, when the Avengers came out, just as it you immediately brought it to my head, but when the Avengers came out, there was a guy on Wired's Geek Dad who is an archery guy. And he's studied archery, like, all his life or something. And he did that. He wrote, like, this whole big article on how Hawkeye was holding his bow wrong. And he, in order to get the right amount of tension, he needed to hold it like this and not like this. And he did all the math and everything and had it all laid out and said, this is the way it should have been.
Yeah.
And as soon as you said that, it reminded me of that. And, of course, I've started calling Pacific Rims actually Sons of Pacific Rim, because you can take Jax
Absolutely.
Out of the Sons of Anarchy, but you can't
agree.
Take the actor out of Jax.
You really can't.
No, he was totally Jax the whole time.
he was. That totally cracked me up. But you know, if you search science of Pacific Rim, you get like all of these articles about, you know, the physics and how the, you know, how the dimensional rift should have worked, and there was the one scene where all the fish fall to the, you know, to the ocean floor, and how that was impossible because there was some beautiful science that came out of that. And it made me so geekily happy that we were going somewhere other than spaceships and planets. Like, there's this science. It comes in many flavors. Let's pull some of those stories out.
Did you see that How It Should Have Ended for Pacific Rim?
No, huh?
So there's this whole web series called How It Should Have Ended. And they do flash animation kind of stuff.
And, oh, wow.
And they always do how the movie should have ended. And what they did was they took the scene, I'm going to totally spoil the movie now. They took the scene where...
Spoiler!
Where they get the sword.
Uh-huh.
And they cut the kaiju in half with the sword. And the Jax character, he's like, wow, that was so effective. Why weren't we using the sword from the beginning? And then they show him just sitting in front of the rift, and every time a kaiju comes out, they cut its head off with the sword. And they're like, wow, this is so much easier than, you know, battling them in the city and destroying all those homes and stuff. There's another one coming out, cut the head off. You know, and they just kept, it's hilarious. It's hilarious.
Did you see the article in the Mary Sue? It just came out like yesterday or the day before, about how the newsletter for the Army of the People's Republic of China referred to Pacific Rim as American militaristic propaganda?
No, I did not.
It's hysterical. You totally need to check
that
it out.
That is funny.
It's the funniest thing. It's like, American how? How is this American? Like, well, you know, other than Charlie Hunnam's bad English accent, American accent, which is actually because he's English, and oh, never mind. We just give up completely. It was fabulous.
So, before we started, you said you had an agenda. You had things you wanted to talk about.
Mostly what I wanted to talk about is...
You want to drag editors kicking and screaming into the sunlight.
I really do. I really, really, really do. Because, you know, Hunt Press is one small press. Mm-hmm. We're getting bigger. We're trying to bigger. I'm here mostly to talk to people and see about acquiring stories, because it's about the story. And one of the things we can afford to do as a small press, we're constructed on a zero debt model.
Okay.
Which is not normal publishing, because of the whole, you know, author advances and the whole blockbuster chasing thing, is a debt-based model. And we're little, we can't do that. We can't pull in that kind of debt. So we're doing this completely, you know, on a non-debt model. We can afford to entertain slightly crazier plot lines. We can afford to entertain stories that aren't what people have seen before. I actually have the time to sit and talk to authors about their stories. I don't want to be pitched. I don't want the classic, you know, plot synopsis, that, like, you know, the classic pitch thing.
Right, the elevator pitch.
That's totally not my market. It's totally not my, it's not my model.
Right,
I don't need to go there.
You don't want people coming up and saying it's Seventh Heaven meets Alien versus Predator.
Please God, no. Please God, no. I want people to come up to me and say, hey, I have this story. You want to hear it? You know, and I want to sit down with a cup of tea, and I want to hear the person's story. And part of the gig about being an editor is I have spent like more years of my life than I even want to tell you about figuring out whether it's the colon or the semicolon, or whether it's the N dash or the M dash or the hyphen or the minus sign. It's four different marks, mm-hmm. and they all have their own place. And I have been in an editorial meeting where we shouted at each other, like, you know, like veins in the neck and red faces, over which mark goes in which place. So, you know, I've endured this kind of grammatical pain.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. I have heard from so many authors who've said, oh, I've written this story, but it's not ready yet. Because they're busy reliving their junior high school English teacher nightmares. I'm not that person. I'm not your junior high school English teacher, and I'm not here to give you a crappy grade. I'm here to look at your story and say, that is a killer story. Let me deal with all that other junk. And
so I'm confused. You don't want, when someone submits to you, you don't want them to diagram every sentence? And do the little line with the house and the prepositional phrase coming off the dog ear end, you know?
Yeah, right? I take it as a sign of respect when people bother to do spell check, because that's just, you know, basic bonehead level due diligence. But we just published a book from an author that we met at LostCon last year, who the guy is self-taught. He's never been through, you know, the grammar paper mill. And he does all sorts of crazy things with the mechanics of the English language, but his story is awesome. It's called Brass Jack. He thought it was one book. It's actually a trilogy.
And who's the author?
Robert Suter.
Okay.
And you can find him on our site. He's got his little author page. He did an interview with Krypton Radio, which is a big science fiction radio show down in the Los Angeles area. So it's Brass Jack, and it's three books. We published the first two. The third one's going to be coming out early next year. The mechanics, I mean, he actually apologized to me formally in his Krypton Radio interview about the commas. He's like, Bree, I'm so sorry about the commas. It's like, dude, it's okay. It's this awesome story, and it's, you know, he's woven in, you know, four different plot lines, and everything intersects, and there's all of this backstory that he managed to completely fill in without ever once resorting to the, well, as you know, Jim, like, never once, ever in the book, that the commas are all in the wrong spots. It's like, I can deal with the commas. The commas are at my pay grade. Do you have a story? Like, bring us your story. We want to hear that, you know?
I have a friend who is my comma Nazi. I send her stuff, and she reads it for me. I'm actually going to see her Saturday night. She's coming down from where she lives here in Texas. But she reads, she'll go through the story, and she will tell me where all the common mistakes are.
Nice.
And it starts off with, you know, just a comment. Here's, this is the wrong spot for the comma. And about a quarter of the way in, it starts changing, and the comment usually is, it gets the hose. And as she goes through and marks all the commas that are wrong, it gets the hose. It gets the hose. It gets the hose.
See, what I did with Robert is the first wrong one was, this is why editors drink. And then the next one was, more beer. And then we went through more beer for like, well, it's a trilogy, right? I mean, there's a lot of commas involved there. And then we went on to... you know, tequila, and then we did sake, and then we did, you know, rum.
And you know what? This is way digressing, but it's kind of funny. If you start getting involved in writers' groups, you start to think like a little bit like an editor.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you're critiquing other people's writing, you start finding the mistakes that you never see in your own stuff.
Right.
I had a friend who did two books, two epic fantasy books, and there was two main characters, two women. And I started to notice the two women a lot. The two women went off together. The two women were riding horses. The two women were fighting with the bad guys. The two women were chatting. The two women went to sleep. The two women were on guard duty. And I started circling them. And on every page, I would circle them and just put grr. Circle. Grr. Circle. Grr. Circle. Grr.
Nice.
You know, and I think it's almost, it's good to use humor, because then it doesn't hurt as bad. It's like, oh, you know, you're stupid. Look at all these things. No, you made mistakes, but it's okay.
I'm an ally. I'm not a gatekeeper.
Right.
I'm not your junior high English teacher.
I want to make it better.
Money for every correction I mark.
Right.
Like,
I want to make it better.
I want to make it better. I want to help you polish it, but I want your story. Like, I want your story.
So now, what's the website for the small press?
Huntpress.com.
Okay.
We actually just revamped our website, and we're very excited. It's like, ooh, it's all professional and shiny and everything. Stephen Radecki is our new web guru. He hopped on. He's like, I love your books, but oh, your site is horrible. And we're like, yes, it is. Are you volunteering? And he said, oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's also a common theme in publishing, to be honest with you, is really bad websites.
Yeah, we noticed.
Yeah. So you mentioned the trilogy. Now, what else do you have out that folks might be really interested in?
We've got another trilogy. We keep, and I think this is something that speaks in our favor, is we keep getting these authors who bring us a story, and then they bring us their next story, and then they bring us our next story. And we've got a bunch of series. Monica Marrier, who also is a comic book artist for Tangent Artists, which is out of Virginia, has done... it's called the Linus Weedwhacker series, but the first one is Must Love Dragons, the second one is Runs in Good Condition, and the third one just hit my desk right before I left to come here.
Nice.
So we'll see how that one goes. and that's sort of a typical dungeon crawl fantasy kind of thing, but Monica has a very practical current world sort of twist to it that makes it hysterically funny. There's a story about a section in there about one of the main character's children throwing a temper tantrum during a business meeting. They're figuring out how to, you know, storm the castle, and the kid's like, I want a cookie. I want the cookie now. I want the cookie now. Fabulous stuff. We have a young adult series written by Eric Krauss, who has published a number of other works with other publishers. He moved to us recently, and that's called Dragon Guard. And his second book just hit my desk 2 weeks before I came here. Like, can I afford to come here? Because all my authors are going to start howling for my blood shortly.
So. Well, I will clue you in. There are editors who and authors who come to WorldCon, but they do block out time to do other stuff. So I was sitting in the bar last night, and I was talking to various different authors as I'm moving around, and there was several of them that said, you know, well, I'm doing this, this, and this, and then I blocked out 3 hours to write. And then I'm going to do this, 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 and that. And I mean, it does happen.
I get that it does, although frankly, like, I was checking the WorldCon site like a rabid ferret, like, where's the program? Where's the program? Where's the program? There's the program! Yeah! And I'm like, you know, triple, quadruple, like, I want to see that, I want to see that, I want to see that other thing, and I'm going to be at that, and like, I've got to be there. And
did you get the app?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Like, the instant they was... little compulsive about some things, you know, and there's so much here that I want to experience. I'm not entirely sure I'll make it to London. I don't know who's going to win the 2015 bid, so I definitely wanted to sort of suck this place dry of every experience it has to offer.
Well, that's cool. That's cool.
Yeah,
so
enthused.
So what else do you want the listeners of SF Signal to know?
You know, I want them to know that in... You know, even in writing groups, writing workshop groups, talking on boards, looking at the Twitter chats, there's this perception that authors are going to have their walls papered with rejection. Get used to it. I hate that. I hate that like burning. I hate it like burning. Because it sets up this whole bizarre hierarchical, you know, you must prove yourself worthy to us. I mean, the writers are the ones who are coming up with stories. We're just building this commercial infrastructure for them to, you know, to come into. It makes me crazy when I see so many people with so many beautiful stories. And if they personally can't get past that whole gatekeeper monolith, you must prepare for rejection thing, then their story just languishes.
Well,
and it breaks my heart.
We can talk a little bit about that because it is a reality. I mean, if you're trying to get published with the quote-unquote traditional Big Six, you are going to paper your walls with rejection.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And maybe where we need to frame this conversation is a lot of authors don't think about small press. They shoot for the moon.
That's true.
You know, and there's a lot of authors. I mean, look who was published through Nightshade. A lot of really good, solid books, solid authors,
true.
Sina and the different ones, you know,
true.
All through Nightshade. They didn't go that traditional route. I wouldn't consider Angry Robot to be the traditional route.
Absolutely.
You know, so there are these presses out there. And you can just sit there and look at
them. I personally have an unholy love for Subterranean.
Okay, yeah, Subterranean is another good one. So there are other markets, but I think that people get tunnel vision.
I think you're absolutely right.
You know, and if it's not through Ace, or it's not through Tor, or it's not through Bane, you know, it doesn't count.
Right.
Well, it does count.
Right.
And to be honest with you, I got a guy, I brought him to SF Signal, who was going to write articles about small presses. And I think he wrote 2, and then he disappeared. And he doesn't write them anymore. You know, because
that
was one of the things that I wanted to do was bring more attention to the small press.
Awesome.
Because there are so many of them.
We appreciate it.
And if you go to the smaller cons, you will see them at the tables. They do get tables in the deal room. And they're
exactly.
Sitting there with their books. And you know, 9 times out of 10, they're not gatekeepers. They're really nice people who want to talk to you.
Exactly. And I appreciate that message getting out there because it's very uphill sometimes. We have spent a ridiculous amount of time answering the question, why us? Like, why should you bother with a small press versus shooting for the moon, doing the, you know, the Big Six thing? And And there's so many ways to answer that question. You know, if what you're into this for is the fame and the glory and the name recognition and the, you know, six-figure advance, by all means, rock on. You know, right. I mean, who wouldn't love to say, you know, I'm an author published by Tor. I mean, who wouldn't love that? Everyone would love that. But do you want to tell your story or not? Do you want your story out there or not?
Mm-hmm. And these are decisions that people have to make. Exactly. And a lot of times with a smaller press, the rights can be a little bit different.
True. Absolutely.
You know, you go to somewhere like a Tor or like, you know, one of these big ones. They have a set standard contract that they're going to hit you with up front. And it's up to you to negotiate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what rights do you want? And it all affects the money.
Right.
The smaller presses, maybe they don't have an ebook arm. So maybe you retain the digital rights. You never know until you go out there and try.
Until you go and try. Which means you have to have a certain amount of self-determination and understanding what it is you want to ask for. You have to understand what rights you want to retain. And I think the other thing that intimidates authors about coming to small press is that you're going to have to do a bunch of your own legwork. Like, we're going to kill ourselves to do promotions on our level, but we don't have the 8.5 by 11 colored glossy marketing budget that the big guys do. We are social media ferrets.
But a better way to frame that is there are authors listening to this and who are out there right now who want more control.
Control we can hand you. That's
easy. They want more control over. And you hear the horror stories of people like, well, I went with this big publisher, and 6 months down the road after my book is out, people are asking me, what did I think about the marketing? And I didn't even know there was any marketing.
Ouch.
Right?
Yeah.
Versus when you go with the smaller press, you're going to have a lot more to do. You're going to have that control. You can do some of the marketing. You can do all that stuff that you want to do that you're thinking you can't because you're going down this other road. Trust me, I know this stuff. And I know that we sat down and you thought you were going to school me.
Oh, no.
But I do know this stuff.
I listen to your podcasts. I know I'm not schooling you.
I do pay attention. It's just...
Although the whole what do editors do thing just rip out my heart and...
Well, it is a question because there are, again, but when you go down the traditional route, when you go to these big houses... There's usually more than one editor involved in a book.
Right.
So what do the different ones do? You have a copy editor, you have this editor, you have this editor.
Let me whip out my soapbox on that. Because getting back to the whole, you know, the blog posts about, well, sure. How do I vote for the Hugo-nominated editor? What does an editor do? There's what my thing that I was talking about at the beginning is developmental and acquisitional editing, which is finding the stories and getting the people to come in and bring you the story. There's what's called framing, which is continuity and consistency and story mechanics. Then after that, there's copy, which is, you know, dotting the I's and crossing the T's and all of that. Copy editing is actually a really, really intense and, for me personally, combative place to be because there is no such thing as the rules of the English language. They change, they morph, depending on if you're going to be using dialect or not, if your authorial voice is supposed to be prominent, then there's going to be a significant bending of the English language, and your copy editor needs to have a good enough working with your framing editor so that they understand, like,
right.
We left that in on purpose because it's achieving... you know, a voice thing rather than that comma is wrong. You know, there's a thing there. There's a spectrum there. And again, that's another thing that's involved with the editors having time to actually work with your stuff. I see a lot of mainstream published books where it's clear there's been some vanilla smoothing of what could be really rich dialect and isn't. I also think part of that is the reader's responsibility because readers more and more are requesting vanilla. Like, if you publish a book, because I've done this is my horror story, you publish a book with very thick authorial voice, you get the hate mail back from every grammar Nazi on the planet, which is great, they're reading your books, but not so great because they hate your guts and want
right.
your job.
Right.
So, you know, there's this thing there. But, so back to the, you know, what does an editor do? Well, an editor does all those things, voting for an editor in like a, you know, a Hugo context, having once found a big name author and having that big name author having written, you know, 15, 20 books, chances are their submissions are clean, their chops are solid, their voice is established. There's not a lot to do there, really. Whereas if you've got a new author who's maybe got a book or two, their personal voice isn't maybe quite established, or maybe they're reaching to try to do something different. Mm-hmm. That editor is going to have a lot more involvement. You know, did you mean to say this? Did you mean this implication? Did you mean this connotation? Like, where were you going with that? Because as the author is trying to find their way through creating this sculpture of a story the way they wanted it, the editor's the one going, you know, is that chip intentional?
Right.
You know, do we need to, you know, whip out the Dremel there? How do we deal with this? So there's so much that an editor can do depending on, you know,
right,
what state things are when they get. So as far as I personally am concerned, I looked at the editors who had the greatest stable of brand new authors, and those guys got all of my votes because they were the ones who were clearly out hitting the pavement. I imagine their, you know, their email queries back and forth are probably prodigious, and those were the ones I voted for.
Did you hear the I think I mentioned it on the episode, I was sitting, I downloaded an anthology to my Kindle, and I was reading one of the stories in there, and I came across a really weird apostrophe. And I wasn't sure if it was supposed to be there. I mean, it just...
Apostrophes in science fiction are so challenging, aren't they?
It broke up the sentence weird. It was just really weird, right?
Uh-huh.
And me being me and having met all the people that I've met, I knew the editor. And so I picked up my phone and I sent the editor... Number one, I took a picture of the page on my Kindle. And I sent it to the editor and I said, is this right? Is this wrong? Does this need to be fixed? What is this? And immediately got a response. It's like midnight. I immediately get a response from the editor, right? And the editor's like, oh man, let me see if I can fix that and if we can get it fixed in the next version. And then 15 minutes after that, I get another email back. I was looking at the original text, and believe it or not, that's grammatically correct. It is, I know it looks weird, but it's correct. And so we're really not gonna change it, but thanks for catching that, you know? And it was just this really weird, surreal experience. Number one, being able to email the editor.
Right.
Number two, having the editor reply to me at 12:15 a.m.
Right.
And having this conversation about this strangely placed apostrophe.
Because we're new and because we're little, I spend a lot of time interacting with anyone who reaches out to us, including the haters, because,
mm-hmm,
you know, there are. And,
it is the internet.
It is, I know, right? And it is amazing to me the number of people who get outraged. I mean, they've got a deep and fiery passion that I am wrong. Like, someone on the internet is wrong. And they want to tell me, like, you screwed this up, this thing in this book on this page. Wrong! And I've had some of the most brilliant conversations with those people because you do. You go back and you're like, well, okay, yeah. If you look at, you know, Oxford, yeah, that's not so cool. Or maybe Chicago. Chicago says maybe one way or the other. If you went with AP, maybe not. But here's this thing the author does. Go back and look at, you know, this page. This is their voice. This is how they're expressing this thing. And if you read it in the context of their voice, like, it's going to drop you out in this other cool place. So just stick with us. And I get really good responses to that.
Yeah, on SF Signal, every once in a while, someone will comment that we screwed something up in a post, and we just say, Fred Kish, leave it alone. It's fine. It's not that big deal.
But so. I think that's part of, because we editors have set it up so badly as this bizarre hierarchical, I am your 8th grade grammar teacher thing, that people are so chuffed when they find that we blew it. You know.
And you don't look anything like Miss Canoe.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Right on. you know, they're so excited to have found us, you know, because they think we're all about finding their errors. That's not it. And they're so excited to find our mistakes, but that's not it either. You know, like, we can get past this and into, let's just tell stories. Let's tell as many stories as we can, as fast as we can. Go.
I had an editor pick out one line from a novel that I wrote and said, this is your character's entire being, and you need to move this line to the very start. And then, because it's all about her, it's her, it's what motivates her, and you've got it way over here, and it needs to be way over here, and it needs to be that point on, you know, her end all being. And it was completely right, and I never thought of it that way. And that's something that an editor sees that the author may not.
That's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to be, you know, a perspective, maybe. If we can get to the point where writers and editors are in the same place at the same time with the understanding that we're all on the same side. Like, it's all about the story. It's not about the power trip. And, I've seen the power trip thing happen. I actually got taken to task by an older, more redoubtable editor who informed me that I was shaming my profession because I wasn't acting entitled enough.
Wow.
Which I think really just says it all.
Wow.
Really says it all.
That's like, crazy.
It's crazy, but, you know, she was making the big buck having an entire career of crushing small authors under her feet like Godzilla. See, there's the whole Pacific.
Yep, you brought it back.
I brought it back. Awesome.
So, we are running up on our time that I promised you. What do you want to close with? What do you want to tell people?
I want to ask people, you know, if you are one of those people who has a story and you think that you might be able to consider a small press, come check us out. Huntpress.com. There's a submission page on there, huntpress.com/submissions. Go ahead and check that out. If you're here at Worldcon, come find me. My name is Loreen Hudson.
Unfortunately, they won't hear this.
They won't hear this until late, huh?
Right.
Well, then hit the website.
Do you have a Twitter?
We absolutely do have a Twitter.
Okay.
It's Hunt Press, and I run that.
Okay. I'll do is I'll tweet out your little message.
Thank you.
And then, that way that we'll get it out there during Worldcon.
Thank you. I very, 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 very much appreciate
it. Not a problem.
I know that, you know, there are a gazillion small presses. I know there are even, you know, a gazillion here, and there's so much story to go around. Like, it doesn't even need to be a competitive thing. Like, you know, shout out to Candlemark and Gleam, who are, you know, big allies, and so many others. There's so many other little presses who all have something awesome to add to this whole story.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thank you for taking the time to chat with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
No problem.
Thank you for listening to the SF Signal podcast. Our podcast is available for download every week at sfsignal.com or via iTunes. Look for the link to subscribe in the sidebar at sfsignal.com, and you can also search SF Signal in iTunes to find the feed. To comment about this or any of our podcast episodes, please call our voicemail line at 720-277-9082. If you enjoyed this podcast, help us boost the signal by telling your friends. Visit the Hugo Award-winning sfsignal.com for all your speculative fiction needs. John D. and the SF Signal Irregulars offer up new content every day, from weekly mind melts featuring your favorite authors, editors, and artists from the SFNF field, to book reviews, original articles and essays, new author spotlights, movie reviews, videos, science fiction, fantasy, and horror tidbits, free fiction roundups, and the new genre-related crowdfunding roundups. Click the RSS button in the sidebar to ensure you never miss a post. The SF Signal podcast is powered by the Functional Nerds.
Wah, wah. And scene.